We talk a lot on this podcast about chess improvement, but when it comes to improving your hiring processes, Indeed is the platform you need. Indeed has over 350 million global monthly visitors, and it has a matching engine that helps you find quality work candidates fast. You can use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with your candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree that Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. Years ago, when I was running a chess teaching business, I found it hard to find good help, and I had to go through a lot of back and forth to even screen potential candidates. Indeed allows you to do those things efficiently in one place. Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences, so the more you use Indeed for hiring, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of Perpetual Chess will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility if you go to Indeed.com/chess. Just go to Indeed.com/chess right now, and you'll be supporting our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast, Indeed.com/chess. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Hello, everyone. I am Ben Johnson, and this is the Perpetual Chess Podcast. Perpetual Chess is a weekly chess interview show with accomplished chess players, authors, personalities, and adult improvers where they discuss their lives, their careers, and share tips about how to improve at chess. For more information, go to perpetualchesspod.com. So without further ado, let's get to the show. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another special edition, World Championship edition of Perpetual Chess. First of all, I want to welcome any new listeners. It looks like a lot of people have been tuning in for the World Championship. So if this is your first time discovering this podcast, just wanted to give a couple quick notes. We are a weekly and sometimes more long-form chess interview show. Generally, we've interviewed world champions like Viswanathan Anand and Alexander Kosteniuk, content creators like Levi Rosman, aka Gotham Chess, and Daniel Naroditsky, and authors like GM Jakob Augard, Bruce Pandolfini. If you're more into chess improvement, you can check out our adult improvement series, where accomplished amateurs share study tips. We even do book reviews once a month or so. We've got one coming soon. But of course, this episode is about the World Championship, and we are joined by a friend of mine who is joining us from Dubai. He has been omnipresent in the chess.com coverage. You can often see him flagging people down, especially Jan Nepomniachtchi, after the games, and then asking good questions during the press conferences. He was the 2012 Chess Journalist of the Year. He is also known as Fun Master Mike, as the lead content creator for chesskid.com. He's a FIDE master. He was a Scholastic champion. He's a Globetrotter, and he is being very gracious to join us while he's super busy covering this event. So, Mike Klein, what's going on?
Oh, that was just about the best intro I could imagine. Just got done with round five, and I'm eager to join. I haven't been on your show in a couple of years. I thought I was getting the cold shoulder, but you actually named some pretty hefty guests. I can see why I was relegated to episode 200 and whatever we're at now.
Yeah, no, it's nothing personal. And actually, with return guests, I'm always, unless they explicitly say they're happy to do it anytime, I'm always a little trepidatious about asking people. I feel like once you've asked them once, you're not sure, like, should you keep going or not? And anyway, anyone who did not hear our first interview with Mike, it's episode 85 from 2018. So if you want to know a lot more about Mike's background and our history as roommates in Brooklyn in like 2003 or something, man, we're getting old. You can hear all about that. But back to the World Championship. So before Mike and I start discussing it, I'm going to just do a quick breakdown of what has happened so far. You guys hopefully heard the breakdown from the first bonus pod, but games 1-3 were draws, as I discussed in that pod. And guess what? Games 4 and 5 were draws too. So we're tied after 5 games. Just to tell you briefly about the games that took place in the last 2 days. In game 4, Magnus switched it up to 1e4, and Jan Nepomniachtchi encountered with the Petrov defense, the Russian defense, which is sort of a symmetrical opening. So it can, it's known as a very solid, some might say sort of dull opening, a bit surprising. mildly surprising for a swashbuckling player like Nepo, although he did play it in the candidates. Magnus in that game seemed to hope to catch Nepo unprepared with his move 18, knight h4. It seemed like he was relying on some complications that he found in a line and certain lines that Nepo could go into, but you could call it bad luck. Nepo hinted that he had looked at this move himself, even though it was kind of a new move. So Nepo kind of effortlessly steered it towards calmer waters, and Magnus's quote about that game was, "I tried something concrete and it didn't work, but that's a normal result. I didn't expect him to have missed this line completely, but in some other iterations, there can be a lot of difficult decisions to make for black. This is the state of modern chess." On to game five, which happened hours ago as Mike and I sit here. It was a similar story with reversed colors. This time Magnus is black as they have with all their black games. It was a Roy Lopez. It looked like Magnus was steering towards a marshal. Jan Nepomniachtchi avoided the main line of the marshal, so it's what's called an anti-marshal type opening. And Magnus played another unpopular move. He's looking for these sort of less popular moves within solid lines, it seems. He got a lifeless position where Viswanathan Anand on the FIDE broadcast said he is clearly slightly worse, which, a little bit of a fancy way of saying that it's very clear that he's slightly worse. And Jan didn't maximize his chances, and Magnus defended brilliantly and made it look somewhat effortless, and the game fizzled out to a draw. So the three narratives to update from the previous rundown are the same, but in a different order. So I would say the prevailing narrative, the thing I'm seeing people talk about more, are the draws. Obviously, we're five games in. There have been nothing but draws. A lot of grumbling. I personally am not a grumbler, and Mike and I will be talking about this in a minute. But to me, that's like the biggest story now. Number two is, I mentioned that Nepo was playing amazing after the first three games, but I kind of highlighted Magnus's prep. But I would say Nepo's prep has been incredible the last two games, because Magnus is trying to surprise him. Magnus is going for these offbeat lines, and Nepo, I mean, it's like there's a mole in the camp or something. He's ready for everything and just blitzes it out and always seems to be playing from a position of strength. And the number three storyline is still Magnus also is showing good prep. And he's using a different approach. He played e4 as opposed to d4 in his last white. So you could say he's probing with white. He seems to have sort of a long view where he's looking for some sort of chink in the armor, and he certainly didn't find it in the Petrov. So when they come back, he'll have white. And it wouldn't surprise me if he plays something other than e4 again. One more quote before I welcome Mike back in. Viswanathan Anand on the broadcast again said he still thinks someone will break through, but he does admit that if it drags on like this for a while longer, they might start to even buckle down more as it gets as the stakes of the cost of losing becomes higher. So Mike, sorry to keep you sitting there, but I just wanted to make sure everyone was caught up. What are your impressions of the match so far?
Well, I guess the question is, should we be disappointed or not? It's maybe a little different watching at home versus being on site. Being on site, there's always little storylines going on, little things to capture your attention. I could imagine sitting at home, you might be a little bit disappointed, but I will say it's kind of an incredible time to be observing this results independent. You can listen to, the silky dulcet tones of Vichy. You can listen to Anish grandstanding and being bombastic, or, actually just being witty. I can't listen to everybody. So Anish, I don't actually know how you're acting. I'm just kind of assuming you're being very witty and everything. And then Judah is a nice foil, because she's from the non-computer era. And on our own show, we got guys sitting on couches. We got Robert Hess selling merch, and Fabiano learned some four-letter words. It's actually quite a riot. Within each game, there are these little mini opportunities. And, do you appreciate, somebody asked me today, because the Norwegian journalist loved to interview me, has this been like a quality match? And I'm like, well, it depends on what you mean. Like, but accuracy of moves, yes. But quality in terms of interesting or excitement, I don't know. Like if a football match ends 0-0, the goalkeepers have a great game. Do you call that quality? Personally, I would. I'm a goalkeeper. But, we're also barely one third of the way in. So, I want to say, Ben, I am starting to hear some people say that they actually think it's a very real possibility it will be all draws, which I don't know. I mean, you're a guy who used to play odds for a living. in each individual game, I get it, but nine more games at the time of this recording, I don't know. I think I heard Anish say it on the air, and I will tell you that MVL is here as a tourist, and he said in a private conversation yesterday, he thinks there's a very real chance as well. So that's not good, but anyway, that's the story from Dubai.
Yeah, well, first of all, shout out to MVL, also has been on the podcast for any new listeners. And yeah, it's, you know, it is what it is, as they say. I mean, they're playing, as you say, so accurate. Nepo in game four said he wasn't sure, but might have had the whole game in his notes. So, I mean, first of all, these guys are geniuses to begin with. But then the fact that they're not really managing to surprise each other means that, like, they're able to just reel off so many engine moves, which also shortens the game and diminishes the chances of a mistake when they do have to think for themselves because they were able to play quickly earlier. So, yeah, I mean, I don't remember what Ty Pruce Zimmerman, shout out to him, who did preview number two with me of the Chess by the Numbers blog. He actually updates the probabilities of a draw, although I think he might go with the sort of base rate of a draw as compared to sort of the world championship rate of a draw. But in any event, I'm sure statistically it's still under 10%, I would guess. But obviously watching, it doesn't feel that way, especially given the trend of the last couple games, and especially to throw in some anecdotes, again, referring to what Viswanathan Anand, it does make sense to me that, like, they could start to kind of try to take the air out of the ball as it gets to a few games from tiebreak. So it's a concern, but it's the state of modern chess. I mean, I feel like we first, Mike, have to address, like, people complaining about it. I see some people criticizing FIDE. Now, I am not, like, a diehard FIDE defender by any means, but they decreased the number of rest days and they got rid of increments heading into this match as compared to prior ones. And to me, those are steps in the right direction. There are a lot of people who are big advocates for slow classical world championships. So there would be a lot of consternation if they did anything more drastic. So to me, they made a step in the right direction. They're, you know, kind of swimming with the tide, at least. It's just, you know, Anish Giri had a funny line in an article. There was an article about Nepo's supercomputer that he's been using in consultation with, like, a Russian university. And of course, this ended up being a bit of a story. I believe that chess.com's Peter Doggers ended up picking it up after Martin from Say Chess wrote about it. Shout out to Martin. And Anish tweeted, like, you know, newsflash, this super engine still says 0-0-0, meaning chess is still a draw. And these are the best players in the world. So, I mean, Mike, I don't feel like, you know, everyone has a different opinion, but to you, are these games, like, dull? And do you think this needs to be changed? Or is it too early to even be having these conversations?
I think it's too early. You know, talk to me when we get to round 12 or 13 and they start actually affecting their style of play because they're just trying to get to the finish without making a mistake. But I have found it fascinating, and I asked Magnus this a couple of days ago. It has absolutely been a through line in his career that he wants to do things to make the world championship more exciting, even if it significantly decreases his chances of keeping the title. I don't even think he's against a March Madness type single elimination tournament, which would massively decrease his chances of keeping the title. So he's always been on the side of more sport, less science. And at some point, you cannot ignore the fact that the world champion is advocating for something more exciting. And it may just be that he's personally bored, this being his fifth classical world championship. Now, I got some pushback the other day when I defended somebody on Twitter saying we should have the rapid tiebreak first. This is not a novel idea, certainly not my idea. But that way we guarantee some fast chess and we go into the classical with somebody already having draw odds. I don't really see a negative to it. I don't know why anybody would push back on this. You're just setting the tiebreak over the board and you're having, I mean, imagine, wouldn't it be exciting right now if we knew who would win in case of a 7-7 tie? Tell me that would not be more exciting. Walk me down that road, you know? That seems like the simplest way to add spice to this without really greatly affecting the fact that it's still going to be classical chess.
Yeah, Vladimir Kramnik was the first person I heard suggest that idea. And I know that Hikaru, in a post-game interview he did on chess.com the other day, also echoed that it might be time to move in that direction. I mean, I'm fairly progressive on this stuff. I love the classical chess world championship cycle, despite generally being in favor of faster games. So something like that to me strikes me as a happy medium. But as you say, you got pushback on Twitter. I know there are a lot of dyed-in-the-wool chess fans who wouldn't be happy with a change like that. But as you say, like, Magnus's opinion should matter. Now, some might say that because he's amazing at faster time controls as well, that sort of frames his perspective. But I'm not sure. And in any event, I mean, a couple people have made some good analogies online. I mean, as even Magnus in the press conference today, as he said, like, with every draw, the tension mounts. So to me, there's going to be another, you know, there's going to be another big opportunity for one of the players. Even if the games end in draws, I don't think they're all going to be lifeless. I especially think that it seems like Nepo might just try to keep hammering on this Roy Lopez line. And I'm not sure if Magnus is going to crack. Whereas Magnus, I still feel like he's in probe mode, probably for at least two more whites. And, you know, he might find something or he might overstep. So we'll see. Should be interesting. So, Mike, this is what, your third World Championship attended? How many have you been to? It was probably more than that, actually.
Well, it's my fourth, although my first was in Sochi 2014. And to be fair, I did arrive about halfway, swapping out with Peter Doggers. Although I will say now, I'm almost 99% chess kid. So going as a journalist again, it's like a perk of the job. I've gotten to the point in the company, thankfully they treat me very well, where I'm like, I'm sending myself to the World Championship. And they're like, okay, yeah, that seems about right. But Peter Doggers is also on the road a little bit less. And it actually works out great because I can produce all the on-site content while Peter is several time zones more favorable, that is to say several time zones behind Dubai, who can write the written report and not be up until midnight, which is always one of the most annoying things, is writing a long report after a long day of reporting. So it's a nice 1-2 combo we've got. And of course, we've got this awesome live broadcast. So yeah, it started out very, how shall I put this, intimate. The Sochi will probably always be my favorite world championship simply because it was November, it was the off season. Nobody was going for warm weather. There wasn't snow yet for snow sports. So the hotel was empty. And Magnus and Vishy were both staying at the same hotel. Don't think that's happened in the last couple world championships. And Magnus would come down at night and, you know, play blitz. And I don't know if he had a drink. I don't remember. Probably not. But he would just kind of hang out in the middle of the world championship. And then on the off days, he needs warm bodies to play football, soccer, and basketball against. And who was there? Just the journalists. So we had this understood agreement that after, you know, 3-4 hours of playing sports, that we would put the ball down, we would pick up our cameras and our notepads, and he would have to reciprocate by giving us interviews. So those were the halcyon days of world championships. But luckily this year, I'm getting a little bit of extra access, and I'm able to go behind the stage for the very first time, and I get a very regulated amount of time with Nepomniachtchi. It's all very contractual, all very regulated, but to his credit, Nepomniachtchi has been fantastic in those interviews, very effusive, happy to do it. And yeah, it's kind of a privilege getting the sort of the first crack at the players.
Yeah, and Nepo, of course, signed a deal with chess.com. I'm sure not entirely coincidentally in terms of the access that you mentioned, but I've really enjoyed those press conferences. Yeah, and it does always sort of feel like, you know, 2.5 minutes in, it's thanks for your time. So it's like, good question, good insight, good question, good insight, goodbye. But
there's actually a Russian media outlet that also gets a very tightly regulated amount of seconds with him. And I do mean seconds. And I actually ask her, to grab me by the shoulder when I've reached my allotted time limit, because you lose conception of time when you're talking. And sometimes you've got three great questions and you ask your first one and Jan is so excited. All your time is spent listening to Jan's response. And I'm trying to ask him questions that don't allow him to have a long recitation of moves. But I'm also the very first person to ask him questions after the game. And sometimes he sort of can't help itself. And I have noticed a couple of times, he recites this very long string of variations. And then he kind of looks at me. He's like, in a way of saying, like, did you get all that? You're only in FM. Right, yeah. Did you get all that? And in my mind, I'm not actually listening so much to what he's saying. I'm just waiting for a pause so I can get my next question in.
Yeah, it was funny to see at one of the press conferences, Hans Niemann was there from Chessable. And of course, being like a young, on the come up, super strong grandmaster, he starts asking them questions about their opening choices. And pretty soon they're like doing a blindfold postmortem. And I definitely agree that that's to be avoided if possible. But you know, that's the way these guys' minds work. They're just on another level. So Mike, I've got some more sort of meta questions. You know, this being audio only and there being so much great visual coverage of the match, I feel like there's only a bit more we can say about, like, sort of, you know, the big picture, what's going on with the match, what to expect. And then after that, we're going to take a break and get back to what you were talking about of sort of what it's like being a journalist there. And we've got some great Twitter questions for you. But in terms of the chess, with when they come back for three games Friday, do you have anything you expect to see? Dare you make any opening or result type predictions?
Yeah, that's always the hardest question, because if anybody asks you what's the result of a single game, you would clearly have negative EV to say anything except draw. I'm trying to borrow a page from your old career. You know, this is the question that the Norwegian journalists ask me a lot, too. I do think that we will continue to see the pattern that Magnus will try a completely new opening, whereas, you know, Jan seems insistent on plugging away at different types of re-Lopez's. I don't think we'll see another Catalan, and I don't think we'll see another repeat of round four, where he plays the D4 line in the Petrov, but I don't know what he has prepared. I did interestingly ask Magnus a couple of rounds ago, and this is a public question, so some of your listeners may have heard this, how much are you hands-on with the in-match tweaks to your opening prep, or how much do you just trust the advice of your seconds? And he was very cagey in his response. He didn't even want to reveal that. I kind of have to think he's hands-on, though. I mean, I just don't see a scenario where Peter Heine says, okay, today we're going to do this. And he's like, yeah, okay, I can't see that road being taken by him. So, another draw, Ben, but I don't know how we'll get to that draw.
Yeah, I did catch that question. Yeah, and he did concede at the end. He said, like, ultimately the decision rests up to me. And in terms of opening, now that he suspects/knows that, you know, the Petrov is likely to be Nepo's main line, I definitely, as you say, I don't think he's going to try the line he did last time again. Maybe he'll try 5 Nc3, or as you said, he might switch to something different entirely, like an English or a Queen's Gambit declined or whatever it might be. But I look forward to the continued variety in openings, and I'm, you know, I definitely wouldn't expect him to try the exact same line that he did last time. So we will see. And then it's back to black, and we'll see what happens in these Roy Lopez's. I mean, it does feel like it's been a little close for comfort for Magnus with black. Like, he is holding. It was, to my mind, impressive. Mike, you're there covering it, so I know you're hopping in on watching broadcast when you can, but it's probably not the same as for me sitting at home, really able to focus on them and switch around. And, you know, there was a moment late in game five today where, like, I switched to Anand and he sounds quite concerned about Magnus's position. Switch to Judit and she says it's like a 50% chance white will win. Meanwhile, I'm staring at Cess, one of the strongest engines in the world that you can watch in real time, and it's all zeros, of course. And Magnus has started blitzing out the moves. And as he said in the press conference, this later became clear. He said he visualized the fortress, and like once he had it, he had it. And a little later, when I switched to Anish Giri, he kind of made the same insight where Magnus sort of sees it now. But anyway, to my mind, it was quite an impressive defense, but still it's early enough in the match where I'm slightly hard pressed to believe he just wants to have zero chances. Like Magnus himself said in today's press conference, he felt like the last two moves he made of the game where he finally got his rook down the open A file were like the only moves that could be considered active. He only had a couple pieces cross the fifth rank, cross midfield. So maybe he'll switch it up. We'll see. But anyway, in a minute, Mike, we're going to take a break and hear from our sponsors. Do you have anything to add on sort of the actual match strategy before we get to what it's like over there in Dubai?
No, I probably have a little bit more insight into, like, you know, what it's like to be here than anything that your viewers can't already see. But I will say that one interesting thought that I had today is that Magnus is enjoying the press conferences a lot more than usual. Today, Nepomniachtchi was the most down of any day that he's had here so far. Magnus has even sort of complimented the press on good questions. Some of the ones you've already talked about, perhaps notwithstanding, but I mean, there's good questions, but there's clearly some people that step to the microphone because they want to be heard. It's actually not as bad as in past years where the fans are in the same place as the media. We'll talk about that in a minute, perhaps. But I actually think that in some ways, Magnus is enjoying this experience a little bit. He's usually, when he comes to a press conference and he's down, he remains down the entire press conference. And somehow he's always ended the press conference a little bit more upbeat and jovial. And today he almost felt like he was a little sly guy by avoiding this C4 move that would have given Nepomniachtchi some chances. And you know, he wasn't happy with his play, but I think he kind of felt like he maybe got away with one today. Whereas Nepo admitted pretty much to me that this was his biggest chance of the match. The game two exchange up position was not that easy for him, he said. So anyway, when it comes to the chess, that's, you know, I can't add a whole lot that Cess won't overrule me on. Right. But yeah, they're playing very close. They're Cess-like so far.
Yeah, and just a final note, I did find it super interesting, the point you highlighted about Nepo saying that he felt like today was a better chance than game two, because yeah, Cess was like plus 1.8 or something, and I apologize for being a slave to the engine, but I just can't help myself when I'm sitting watching at home, and I do try to form my own thoughts and listen to the Super GMs sharing theirs as well, but I can't not look. So on that note, we're going to take a break and hear from our sponsors. I do want to mention these bonus pods would not be possible without the support of the Blue Wire Podcast Network, which has tons of great sort of sports and lifestyle podcasts. Proud to be affiliated with them. And special shout out to all the Patreon and PayPal supporters of Perpetual Chess, who also make it easier for me to stop everything I'm doing and buckle down for the World Championship. Although, let's face it, I would be doing this anyway. So on that note, we're going to take a break and we will be right back.
Podcast Network. This is Pedro from the Arsenal Opinion Podcast, and I am hyped about the title running. Can Arsenal pit Pep and Klopp? Will our young squad be described as mentality monsters? Is Mikel Arteta truly a generational saucy manager? Come and join us on the Arsenal Opinion Podcast to follow the boys on this historic 2024 Premier League title running and hear analysis of the games, the hottest transfer rumours, the Arsenal culture, and the business of football. 3 times a week exclusively on the Sports Social Podcast Network. Search the Arsenal Opinion now and come and join the fun.
All right, and we are back, and we've got a few questions to dive into from Twitter that actually do sort of fit into what we were discussing about the perspective Mike's able to offer joining us live from Dubai. So first question is from Garudapora. I hope I said that right, Garudapora, at Garudapora2 to be precise. He says, as a spectator who's not been present the actual event for the last 2 World Championship matches, I feel like the last match had more drama and excitement surrounding it, even when the audience wasn't as big as it is now. What's your take on the comparison of these 2 matches?
Well, first of all, I believe I've flown Garuda. Isn't that the national airline of Indonesia? But anyway, I digress. What was the question again? I was so interested in getting my joke in there.
Was the last match, did people seem more excited for the last World Championship match in London between Caruana and Carlsen?
Well, it was a smaller building. And remember, they're fundamentally different settings. In London, we were in what I remember to be a pretty posh neighborhood, and they had, you know, decked out the building just for the World Championship. And everybody that was in that building was there for chess, and it got tight at times as far as space accommodations. Now we are a small fish in a big pond. I mean, the expo is like, it's like, we can speak like adults here, right? It's like Epcot Center on crack. Epcot Center has like 8 or 9 country pavilions. There's 190 countries here, many of them with bespoke pavilions befitting whatever their national, you know, identity is. So Norway's is a giant Viking ship, as you can imagine. And we're just like this little event that I would say almost nobody at the expo even knows about. So are people more excited? Well, a lot of people that are milling about don't know how the pieces move because they're just there for the expo or whatever. So London felt more like a chess fans paradise, but this is a cooler event to come to if you want more to do. I mean, okay, you've got a 5-hour rook and pawn endgame coming up. Just go hang out at the Swedish expo and have some, you know, lingonberry pancakes. I mean, you can literally just go and, you know, be a part of all this culture that has nothing to do with the chess event. So I think this fits my style better. In fact, I've been arriving several hours early each day, dropping my bag in the media room and going and just like walking into the different countries. And some of them serve food. There's music everywhere. And it's just really neat. I mean, I know I'm pretty well traveled, but you can kind of experience so many cultures without getting on another plane once you get here. So I could say a lot about what I don't like about Dubai. I don't know how much time you have about that, but the expo itself, it's pretty cool. Now, is it a waste of resources? Yeah, they're going to tear down a lot of it after it's over. Yeah, they call themselves sustainable. I mean, okay, we could start on a rant here.
You and Korblas, such tree huggers. Who knew?
Yeah,
we said the same thing.
I could go Dennis Miller really quick here. I don't want to get off on a rant here, but yeah, I could do that pretty well. And you know, I should mention this is a police state. And we, as a media, I've had several instances where the long arm of the security apparatus has come and wanted to see some meaningless sticker on a microphone or wanted to know who I am or this or that. And I do want to say, since I'm never going to frankly come on your Adult Improver podcast, I would not be welcome there for my own shortcomings. But as a journalist, I do want to let you know, this is, can I say breaking? I don't have the full specifics, but I feel like I can gossip a little bit more on your show than I can on the written pages of Chesscom. But a Norwegian media outlet today asked one of the high-ranking sheikhs some question about controversies about worldwide events being held in UAE, not taking a stance, but just asking the sheikh for his opinion on any controversies about events being held in the region. And security came and confiscated their camera.
Jeez.
Just yikes. for the asking of the question.
Wow.
This was told to me first person by the member of the Norwegian media, somebody who I know from previous events and have no reason to believe would not be telling the truth. But yeah, I mean, I don't mind saying it. We are in a police state. I appreciate some of the things they've done. There is an Israel expo pavilion, by the way, thanks to the normalization of relations with Israel. I did yell Happy Hanukkah at the expo, and I looked around waiting to be arrested. That didn't happen.
Wow.
I don't know what else to say. Now, I do want to clarify something. Every single person I've had an interaction with outside of the security at the expo has been a delight. It is mostly foreign workers, as you might guess. However, I was hosted, you could say, by the Dubai Chess Club. They took us all over the city, helped us film all kinds of features and things. They even paid for like all the little incidentals about this little impromptu tour. Had a great chat with Salam Saleh today, the number one player from UAE. So you have to, I don't know. It's hard to square the circle, so to speak, because the locals are incredibly nice, but you can't forget the fact of, you know, the 1984 nature of this place.
Interesting. Yeah, it's good to hear that perspective, because as I mentioned in the first bonus pod, of course, I have some FOMO for not being there. It's not like, you know, no one was lining up at my door to fly me there anyway. So it would have been a steep hill to climb for me to get there. But when I was, you know, talking to Korblas, who's always entertaining, in the first bonus pod, and on the next bonus pod, we're going to have an interview with National Master John MacArthur, who just came back from his sixth world championship. It's actually already recorded, and he tells some great stories about like both this one and previous ones. So the FOMO was real for that, but kind of what you refer to about the police state is part of the reason I wasn't like, you know, hunkering down for the talk with my wife about skipping out to Dubai. So it's good to get an even-handed perspective. But we have another Twitter question related to the prior one. This one's from Greg Smith. And he asks, he says, do you know if there are more or fewer journalists, and especially mainstream journalists, I'm curious about, than there were in London or New York for the last two World Championships?
Okay, good question. And right up my alley. If I can't answer that, nobody can. My feeling is fewer. In fact, there was a little bit of concern because the media room here only has 20 workstations, which at either of the previous World Championships would have been far too few. It's just based on the size constraints of the particular layout, which is a little bit complicated to describe the layout. But it turns out some of the workstations have gone empty. And so, I mean, you know, the first couple rounds, it was a lot busier because a lot of the mainstream outlets will come out just for the first couple. Like, I know Reuters was here for round one, and they often come back for the final round too. But definitely fewer. London was a little bit more competitive getting a workstation. And you were kind of, you know, sitting on top of each other, so to speak. So the journalism corps is less. And we've brought more people this time. We have some chess.com employees and, you know, and friends of chess.com that have sort of come as fans, and they're helping out a little bit. But it's pretty cool this time because I actually have a videographer with me, and I get to go around and film little features and things. Some of them are lighthearted, and some of them are closer to being serious. So I have a bigger team, but overall, the number of total journalists, I think, unequivocally has gone down. And it's based on the location. It's based on COVID. I would say it's based on a lot of things, not anything FIDE did wrong. In fact, I do want to say, David Yada, who's been the press attaché, the press officer, has been a delight to work with. He has so many competing interests, so many media outlets that need something. FIDE, of course, wants this and that. And he's done a really good job of accommodating me and my requests and treating people fairly when he can. But he has a fairly thankless job. So that should be noted that he's done so well.
Yeah, shout out to David. Awesome photographer, by the way, as well. We've got another question. This one is from my fellow chess podcaster, David Vizgin. And David asks, he says, he saw a clip of Magnus's loss to Karjakin, and you could hear the applause and gasps at the end of the game. So he's wondering how lively the scene is around the game.
Okay, good question. There's a hallway that you do not even need a chess ticket to get into. That's kind of interesting. That's something that I should probably bring up. Meaning, yeah, if you just have a ticket to the expo, if you got into the expo in any way, you can be around a lot of chess. So you can sit and listen to Anna Musichuk and Vishy Anand's commentary. You can, the Botez sisters are here. You can be a part of their show because it's all live. You can just jump in front of that camera. There are chess sets out. There's a giant chess set. There's a lounge from one of the rival websites. I don't actually know how you get in that lounge, but
previously discussed on the show. So,
Oh yeah. I don't know how you get in that lounge, but I mean, I could walk in and say hi to Henrik, but I respect that it's not, it's beyond the 36th parallel. I was trying to name something historical. It didn't quite work. So you only need a ticket to get in the room. Now, the room itself is quiet and dark. Were it not for the darkness, you actually can see the room from the player's table. So I've been inside the room that the players are playing in a couple of times, and you can see out, except when they dim the lights for the actual round. You can bring cell phones in. I don't know if that's just because it's me, because I'm media, but I think even fans, actually, no, I don't think fans can bring cell phones in. But there is clapping after each round, even on the draws. The players can't hear any of that, but you can hear it from the spectator area. So I would say a little bit more space, but they can't fill every seat because of COVID. It's like a proper auditorium type setup. Complete lack of alcohol, as you might guess.
Yeah, well, you should break that down briefly, just for anyone listening who's still thinking about making the trip, because it's a little hard to pin down what exactly the rules are about alcohol in Dubai.
Oh, okay. So I can speak to that. There's a duty-free shop at the airport with pretty reasonable prices, and you are allowed 4 liters. I picked up 2 liters in London and one more in Dubai when I realized my roommates had failed to do their duty and pick up a bottle. So to protect my two good bottles, I bought them a house bottle upon landing in Dubai. That's just tactics right there. Uh-huh. Now, I think it's pretty recent, but they now do actually have liquor stores in the city. Not a whole lot, but enough. You have to show your passport to prove you are not an Emirati citizen. And they actually scan your passport when you buy. Maybe there's a limit. I don't really know. Prices are not very competitive compared to the States, but you can get it when you're in the city. So, but definitely best to pick up as much as you think you might want to drink at duty free. It's just a way better bet. And actually, hotels and bars, you can actually get it at pretty much any restaurant. Pretty expensive. It's probably Norway prices. In fact, the Norwegians are like, yeah, it's the same price as home. So if that tells you anything about the prices here.
Wow.
The expo itself, I have not seen any alcohol at, except, this is breaking news, not the most important breaking news. This is not news that your viewers can, your listeners can use, but I got access to the VIP room today before the round began, of course, on a little private tour. It is where the high-ranking sheikhs hang out. There's talk in case Putin comes out. Of course, he gets to go to this room. And there are some bottles of wine there from a vineyard in Bordeaux that has some connection to the Russian Chess Federation. I think Andrei Filatov owns a vineyard in Bordeaux. I'm having trouble remembering all of the specifics, but apparently somebody packed these bottles of wine in their personal luggage, which is legal. You actually can put it in your luggage, and got them into the expo. I realize I'm getting fairly pedantic here, but let's just tell your viewers, your listeners, I keep saying viewers, you're probably not going to drink anything at the expo, but you'll be okay in the rest of the city.
Okay. All right, there you have it. And Mike, we just have one more question, and we are trying to keep these short, first of all, because you've been working all day, and second of all, because this is like a burn after listening type podcast, you know, for all the people commuting, unable to watch any of the coverage. So this one is from friend of the pod, Brian Karen, who says, has the match inspired any Fun Master Mike instructive positions for your video ideas?
Brian Karen, guess who's getting a holiday card from me? I think I'm Facebook friends with Brian. Yeah, I'm always thinking of positions that I can show kids. In fact, there was a moment during round four where Danny Wrench, Robert Hess, and Fabiano were trying to come up with a name for this particular threefold repetition, and a lot of your listeners can visualize it. You've got a rook on the seventh, the enemy king's on the eighth, and your knight can toggle back and forth, checking the king perfectly, and the knight and the rook are a perfect distance apart. And I already had a Chess Kid video showing that exact idea. So I rushed to grab it and send it to my producers, but I don't think they got it on the show. They actually ended up calling it the Pendulum, which is a pretty brilliant name, actually. So yeah, but I'm always thinking about positions I can harvest and then show on Chess Kid. I'm actually kind of running out of thematic ideas to group into a nice little lesson, but I have a feeling that there's going to be some sort of world championship compendium video that I'll end up doing. And I just want to give one more thing, because my job as a journalist, one more thing that your listeners probably don't know. When Jan Nepomniachtchi is away from the board, he's been away from the board a lot in rounds four and five, there's actually a TV in his break room showing the moves, which is something that the players lobbied for, even though it may not be great to witness because you have empty chairs a lot. But that's something that your listeners may not know about by watching any of the broadcasts. The players can go camp out in their rooms and see when the next move has been made. So that was a kind of a neat behind the scenes thing that I don't know if it's been mentioned on any of the broadcasts yet.
Yeah, Tanya Sachdev from Chess24 did do a little behind-the-scenes thing where you could see the room, so I saw that. I'm not sure about the broadcast, but it is an important point to highlight because it does, especially to like a newer chess fan, it looks crazy, like this, you know, high-stakes event, and like someone's always missing from the board. But the rooms are just too nice. I mean, if I could, like, when I was playing some weekend tournament, if I could go chill in my own little private room with like snacks and stuff and a TV, I'd be all over it as well. So what can you say?
Yeah, I was told by Nepomniachtchi's handlers that he kind of likes the luxury treatment. And I did try to ask him one question about this, but he demurred and said, look, I'm here to play chess. I don't care about the fancy cars and the nice hotel rooms of this town. But I don't know. I mean, Ben, you lived in Russia. You know how they like the finer things. So I don't think he's eating the cheap caviar this month. By the way, they have their own private bathroom, too. They each have their own bathroom, so they can go hang out there, too. Anyway, it's neat to be here, and I do hope some of your listeners, if they do come out, they come say hi. And that's the scene from Dubai.
Awesome. Yeah. And we should mention, by the way, Mike, still showing his writing chops, has an article in the new December issue of Chess Life magazine. For those of you in the United States, be sure to check for that. I enjoyed that article, Mike.
Thanks. Yeah.
Essay, I should say, really. Yeah.
Yeah. It's probably the first article I've written that has no chess in it. Even the biographies I've done of players, we put a perfunctory mention of their best move or whatever. But I enjoyed writing it. It's very reflective. Somebody on Twitter called it spooky. I'm not sure.
Shout out to Todd Bryant.
Yeah. I was very reflective, as I think we all were during COVID, right? If you weren't self-reflective, I don't know what you were doing with your life. So, yeah.
Excellent. All right. Well, Mike, you're on Twitter. You're on Chess Kid. You're on chess.com. Are those the main places people should keep up with your content, as well as the chess.com broadcast, of course?
Yeah, if you can't find me, that's on you, not me. I've actually got funmastermike.com. A lot of people are like, hey, my kid loves you. How can they interact with you? I do some occasional group lessons, and I also will make a video of your child's best game. Nice holiday gift. Now, Vishy Anand is the only chess player on Cameo.com, and I'm trying to get on Cameo, but I haven't gotten there yet. That's where you can record.
That's an amazing idea. For the listeners who don't know Cameo, basically you can order little videos from people. First of all, it's brilliant that Vishy's on there, but you might make a killing on there.
I just want a platform that takes away all of the scheduling. The killing part is secondary. Right. But yeah, it'd be nice to make some of that that Benny the Bank coin. No, I should close by saying, chess.com and Chess Kid has been like a dream job, and they treat me really well. And I'm really lucky that I just get to tell my employer, like, hey, I'm going to Dubai. And they're like, yeah, okay, that's good for the company. Let's do that.
Awesome. Well, we're glad to have you there, and thanks for joining the pod, Mike.
Thanks for having me, Ben. Great to be back.
Podcast Network.